Every wildfire season seems to be getting more intense than the last, but today's guest is here to tell us that wildfires actually have a good side. When fire burns low and slow, they help manage the land by getting rid of undergrowth and brush to help feed the soil on the forest floor. But sadly, due to overplanting, invasive insects, higher winds and temperatures, the wildfires we're seeing today are actually hotter and spreading more quickly than we can contain.
You're listening to Found, TechCrunch's podcast that brings you the stories behind the startups from the folks that are building them. Today, we're talking to Allison Wolf, the co-founder and CEO of Vivrant Planet, a cloud-based planning and monitoring tool for adaptive land management. I'm Becca Skutak, and learning about the nuances of caring for a forest floor is my amazing co-host,
Dominic Bedoya-Davis. And before we get into our conversation with Allison, we have our two truths and a lie. And at the end, of course, we'll tell you which one is not true. So listen carefully to these statements to see which one is a lie. Okay, first, there's one unified group that handles land management in most of the U.S. Two, machine learning experts were the earliest hires on the Vivrant Planet team. Or three, Vivrant Planet spun out of a nonprofit.
You will all have to listen and find out. But before we dive into the meat of the conversation, we have one little request for you, dear listeners. If you have been loving Found, which we assume that you have been, if you wouldn't mind going and giving us a rating or a review on any of the platforms you are already using to listen to this podcast, it helps us out a lot, gives us great feedback, and allows us to continue to make this great show. So if you want to go and do that right now, take a couple of seconds and then dive right back in. Here's our conversation with Allison. Hi, Allison. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
Doing well. Dealing with a little one of those like colds that automatically comes when the weather starts to change for the spring.
Oh.
But can't complain.
Yeah. Well, good. Hopefully it stays low level.
But probably a good place for us to dive in today is maybe you want to start by telling us a little bit about Vivrant Planet.
Yeah. So Vivrant Planet is a science and technology platform that is creating what we call a common operating picture for wildfire resilience and nature resilience. We're sort of taking the term common operating picture from the military and from firefighting. And it's sort of how it sounds. It means urgency. It's critical coordinated decisions. And we're using it in the natural resource management and wildfire resilience building space because we have to. It's very urgent. And we've basically modernized a very slow, often multi-year, even 10-year conflict-ridden process of multi-jurisdictional planning. So we're sort of stealing that term to bring urgency and speed and the best technology and science have to offer to a very big problem.
And maybe we want to break that down a little bit for those of us who are not as familiar with some of the terminology and those processes. Like, what does this look like for, say, a Vivrant Planet user? And who would use this and how would your customers approach this?
Yeah, so our customers are land managers that work for the Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, state parks, national parks like Yosemite, Yellowstone, those kinds of parks. Also fire districts, so fire chiefs and folks that work for them, counties. So those are our paying customers. It's an annual subscription that we sell by the acre. And it's enabling a multi-jurisdictional planning process that's happening now, but it's happening on paper, believe it or not. So land management was one of the last areas that hadn't really moved to the cloud yet. And so we've built a really robust data-driven system. There's a lot of machine learning in there as well that I can get into if you like. But we essentially have everything that has value in a landscape. So imagine like your own neighborhood. You might have your house, your neighborhood, maybe a city or a small town around you. And then around that town, there's usually lots of land. And often once you get further out into bigger landscapes, you're dealing with federal and state lands, so parks and Forest Service, those kinds of lands. Those planning processes become complex. There's a lot of environmental regulation, thank goodness. There's regulation around archaeological sites and things like that, thank goodness. We have to protect all those things. And so once you're in, especially the broader landscape planning space, there's a lot of negotiation. We also, over the last 10 years, have seen this really rapid rise in severe wildfire behavior because of land management decisions, which I can get into, as well as climate change exacerbating grossly overfueled forests because of the way we've managed them for the last 130 years. And so we've got fires moving at 1 million, 2 million acres. And so that's sort of forcing inherently consensus-driven processes, but consensus is really difficult when there's a big lack of trust among different landowners, tribes, Forest Service, BLM, and the public, and then nonprofits that their whole job is to protect specific species, like spotted owl, for example. And so we basically facilitate much better collaboration. So helping people see each other's perspectives, the system enables real-time scenario planning so that they can basically play out virtually this treatment versus this treatment. When I say treatments, that's mechanically thinning overgrown forested areas, putting beneficial fire back on land with prescription. Those are the treatments that our system basically recommends. And this is happening in real time. So imagine moving from a multi-year paper-driven process where nobody trusts the data isn't fine scale enough to actually be accurate, and you can't actually play with this versus that and weigh the different trade-offs of plan. So we've basically brought this very powerful cloud-based data-driven system together to enable that to happen in real time, very collaboratively with spatially overlapped plans. And then it also becomes a monitoring system. So we really haven't monitored natural resources. We don't really know the current risk to water sources, carbon, biodiversity, and even communities. It's been pretty inaccurate to date. So we bring a lot of accuracy to those things in both forecasting and then monitoring current conditions to help prioritize and deploy right now billions of dollars that are moving from the infrastructure bill and the Inflation Reduction Act.
And there's so much there that's so interesting. And I'm curious, with this going from being a paper process, being a process that took so long, having that sort of inaccurate data set, what was it like for you guys to build Vibrant Planet to fix some of those issues? What was that process like getting to where you guys are now?
So I came out of Silicon Valley and did a lot of product strategy and a lot of user experience design. I led marketing and a lot of the early user experience design at Netflix, and then did a lot of that work at Meta and Google and other big tech. So came in with a very kind of user-centric design ethos and spent over a year and a half talking to more than 100 people across emergency services, land management, the scientific community to understand what are the gaps in planning? Where is it frustrating and hard? What do you wish? What do you dream existed? And so there was a lot of input from representative stakeholders and customers, spent a lot of time with tribes as well. Really important to start to bring indigenous knowledge into our space. They manage all of our land for 20,000 years. And then European Americans, unfortunately, screwed it up. So yeah, got a lot of input and then literally sat side by side with people from CAL FIRE and Forest Service and scientists drawing what became our current platform that is an adaptive management platform. The hardest hurdle was creating a fine scale, what we call foundational model. So vegetation, of course, is sort of at the base of the ecosystem. And so we had to map at very fine scale that could hand off to permit processes. So individual trees, individual brush and grasslands was a huge breakthrough technologically. And that's where we apply machine learning, very, very advanced. We have some of the most advanced machine learning talent in the world on our team that really wanted to kind of take what they had developed inside companies, you know, ad platforms and apply it to keeping our planet intact. So we're really lucky to have an incredible tech team that works with our scientists to make sure we have scientific accuracy and efficacy in the vegetation mapping. So we've basically mapped the entire Western United States at 1 meter scale. So we're seeing individual trees and forest structure, shrubland and grassland structure. And then we basically, the other technical feat is to normalize all those other things that have value in a landscape. So built infrastructure, of course, we know has known value, real estate. And then we bring in biodiversity data, key species of plants and animals, water data, carbon data, recreation data, right? Like a lot of the Western United States is a recreation economy. So recreation values are very, very important in Colorado and California and Washington, Oregon, right? So all of that data gets curated in. We find best-in-class data. We're filling gaps as well where there's gaps. We saw a gap in the vegetation data and filled that. And then we normalize the format. So I was watching Forest Service Fuels people, for example, pull down 60 different data sets and then try to massage them for over a year to actually make them workable, to actually create one scenario of a land management plan. It was so painful to watch. So we've basically normalized all that. So everything that has value in a landscape is represented by best-in-class data and science. So that's all ready to work with in this powerful scenario planning capability. So a Forest Service person is managing our public lands for carbon, water, biodiversity, recreation value, and they're also trying to make communities in and around their forests fire adapted. So the tool basically lets them optimize a plan that has all those values weighted for outcomes they want. So they want all those things sort of equally successful at the end of a treatment plan. And then they can put in the constraints they have. So how much budget they have, time, acreage that they want to address in a certain period of time. And then the system basically optimizes and it basically spits out a recommended treatment plan that sequences actions. That's really important now with things changing so fast on us. It's all about prioritization. So the system helps them with go here first because it's the highest risk. You're going to get the most benefit from ecosystem enhancements. And then go here second, here third, if you've only got $10 million to pay workers to go in and thin out forest and prescribe fire burn bosses that get in there and put good fire back on the land. So that's really how the system works. And then it's monitoring. It's monitoring where the forecasted benefits, right? And then it's actually year upon year starting to understand which treatments worked best in what socioecological context. And then how are we seeing resilience trending across these vast landscapes? So you can imagine the chief of the Forest Service being able to aggregate a bunch of insights nationally, and then figure out like, okay, where do I go next with my next $10 billion from the Inflation Reduction Act to make sure that money's going out equitably? We've got a lot of frontline communities at risk that are really hard to map. And how do we know that it's actually safeguarding our communities, our carbon sinks, our biodiversity hotspots, and our water?
Okay, no, all of that is so amazing and so really fascinating. I would love to hear your thoughts on how the practice of land management has changed as the climate crisis continues to get worse. I know that's kind of broad, but I would love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah. So let me quickly dip into history, because I think a lot of people don't know what wild or natural is. So in the Western U.S., as pioneers moved west, you know, 150, 200 years ago, we literally cut everything down. So we had these vast forests. We had 600 million beaver that were creating all these marshy, carbon-rich, biodiversity-rich wetlands because they blocked all the streams up, right? We didn't have water channels as much as we do now, other than the really big rivers. So the Western U.S., where we've got this really catastrophic fire problem happening, was radically different than we see today and that we live in. And of course, there were hardly any people living in these wildlands. They were concentrated in cities like San Francisco or Seattle. And we built everything from wood. So mines, railroads, towns, everything was made of wood. And so we literally played out the Lorax. We cut every tree down. We drained and ditched really carbon-rich meadows and ran sheep on them to grow wool for World War I and World War II uniforms. Like we really, really messed with the systems. There's only 7% old growth left. So just picture the Lorax. I mean, that's literally what the West looked like. And so that fundamentally disrupted the ecosystem function. And then things grew back, but not in a natural way. So that there we had a new forest, shrubland, and grassland structure. Meadows didn't recover for the most part from what we did with them. By the way, a lot of our meadows in the Western U.S. store as much carbon as Indonesian peatlands when they're left alone and healthy. So what's happened is we've got, I'll focus on forests because that's where we're seeing really catastrophic effects and forests converting to grasslands and shrublands that don't store as much carbon. They don't host the biodiversity that forests typically host, right, when they convert to other ecosystems. And it's happening really quickly. So we basically have to get in there. So we've got these forests that grew back. They grew too thick. And then we started suppressing fire 100% of the time 130 years ago. So we put fire out. So I've been talking a lot lately about humans' desire to control nature, right? So we have air conditioning and we have heating. We don't like it too hot. We don't like it too cold. We killed off all the predators. And we're seeing lots of evidence that was a really bad idea, right? And so that's why we've got wolf reintroductions and things like that happening, because we need the top of the food chain to exist for the bottom of the food chain to be healthy. We didn't know that. And then with fire, we controlled fire. We don't like fire. We don't like smoke. And so we've put every fire out. And a lot of the new technology is early fire detection systems that we're just getting better and better and better at that. And it's biting us in the ass, right? So we have these unnaturally structured forests from clear cutting everything. We've got a ton of fuels in there, down branches and things. We've got a lot of trees dying from diseases like bark beetle that are killing billions of trees across the West and Canada. And so we've got these very unresilient forests with tons of fuel. So think about a fireplace or a campfire where you've got a lot of kindling, right, to get the fire going and a little bit of wind. We've got more extreme winds from climate change. And so we've created this perfect storm of tinder dry, tons of load. And so when a fire sparks, whether it's, you know, a cigarette butt, a lightning strike, or a utility pole, the fire is more likely to become catastrophic, where it has ladder fuels. So it doesn't stay on the ground. It actually ladders up into the canopy of the forest. And then climate fueled winds are moving these fires at speeds we've never seen before, to the point where we can't get people out, like we saw in Lahaina, like we've seen in Paradise and Caldor Fire and many others. So what we have to do is sort of mimic the role beneficial fire played for 20,000 years. So both tribes in the West, as well as lightning fire, like we didn't have planes with red retardant to put fires out. Fire rolled through these drier Western forests, same in Mediterranean Europe, Australia, Chile. There's about half of land on Earth that adapted with fire. So the ecosystem needs fire to cycle carbon, to cycle nutrients, and to regenerate. Some of the seeds of coniferous forests only plant if there's Goldilocks temperature fire. So we've created a catastrophic, severe, very hot kind of fire instead of a low intensity regenerative fire because of our actions. And so what our system does is it basically prescribes based on topography and then also where we can get the most bang for the buck in terms of reducing risk to ecosystems and towns, as well as enhancing ecosystem services like carbon sequestration, water reliability, biodiversity hosting. It basically spits out this prioritized sequenced plan that I talked about that helps you get the most bang for the buck. We call it restorative return on investment. So where do you go to get the most benefit with the funds that you've got and the people that you've got? And then it basically says you need these types of workers in this quantity in these places. You're going to have this kind of biomass that can go into climate smart wood commodities for buildings, biochar, and crops, those kinds of things. So it gives a lot of predictive analytics that help create a whole economy around resilience eventually. Also nature-based climate solutions, which I can talk about because it quantifies the ecosystem benefits that we can start to build markets around.
And there's so much there, and you're obviously very knowledgeable about this space. And I'm curious, what got you interested in land management, in these kind of climate adaption techniques? What got you interested in this space to begin with?
Yeah. So I had spent most of my career in Silicon Valley working with amazing leaders like Bill Weil and others at Google and Facebook, which became Meta, of course. Mostly on climate solutions. I was sort of in the for good world at those companies, really trying to figure out with leadership teams, how do we tilt these global platforms towards good? And we had some really big successes and some big frustrations as well along that journey. But a lot of that work was focused on climate solutions and leveraging the weight of the tech world to do what we could. So things like creating a space race for who could have the most efficient data center design, and then getting every company to open source their design so that others could use it rather than it being an opaque kind of competitive advantage. Building coalitions to go into coal-based states to green the American grid. So bringing jobs, building data centers and philanthropy and things like that, and then creating new, truly additional renewable energy in places like Kentucky or Texas. Building huge wind farms to power the grid that was powering the data centers. So after spending a lot of time really working on trying to contribute to that tipping point of making renewable energy cheaper than fossil fuels, which we finally hit, right? I started to get really interested in nature-based climate solutions, mostly inspired by Paul Hawken, who's a prolific author and leader in the sustainability and climate movement. He wrote a book and created an organization called Drawdown. I helped with the book launch, and in working with Paul, started to learn how powerful nature-based climate solutions are and how ready they are compared to things that are very long-term investments like direct air capture to truly get those things to scale. So just started to learn more and more about, you know, nature is ready now. Most of it's a management problem. So how we've managed croplands, we need to move to regenerative ag, which we know rebuild soil and the right type of ag is a massive carbon sink. Like if we can restore prairie lands in the Midwest, some say that that could pull down all the carbon the world emits annually. Forests are the same thing. When they're operating, functioning as normal, they store a third of the carbon that we emit every year. And there's all these other co-benefits of hosting biodiversity. We forget we depend on other species to survive, but we need other species, right? They also, 70% of water comes from forests. And so water is moving through evapotranspiration. Forests, like in the Sierra Nevada where I live, they're this massive refrigeration machine for all the snowpack, right? So if the canopy's wide enough, just enough snow lands underneath and it's shaded by the canopy. Right now, our canopy is so thick, the snow's evaporating without hitting the ground, which is causing our ground recharge of water. It's not happening like it used to. And when we have big fires, you can imagine black soil with no canopy shading it, the water just melts off too fast, right? So we've got to get back to these functioning systems that are delivering carbon sequestration, clean water, and biodiversity services, and then beautiful places to play, right? Like, we love recreating in the West.
More from this conversation right after a quick break.
And right before you launched Vibrant Planet, I saw that you were running your own nonprofit. And so I'm curious to know, what has the jump been from running a nonprofit and now running a venture-backed company? Have there been a lot of lessons, a lot of ups and downs? Like, what has been the learning lessons?
Yeah, so I started originally when I got passionate about this space. So I ended up in the fire-focused space because as I was getting more and more passionate and wanting to land in nature-based climate solutions, I was really wanting to probably land in regenerative ag. I started to see this catastrophic fire problem and how fast it was happening and how severe the damage is going to be in a very short period of time to ag, water, you know, air quality, all of these things. And so turned my attention to trying to work on how do we make ecosystems and communities resilient to fire and more broadly climate change before it's too late, before all those ecosystem services that are going to drive nature-based climate solutions blow up, literally, because it's happening like in the next couple of decades. So I started a nonprofit originally 6 years ago to really do some of that digging on what are the solutions in this space? How do we convene the best thinkers to solve these problems? Started to see this technology problem very clearly, saw a public communication problem. People don't have an understanding of what a healthy forest looks like. They don't like fire, even prescribed fire. So when I got into this a few years ago, I was seeing lawsuits to the Forest Service demanding that the Forest Service pays for their curtains to get cleaned when there was a prescribed fire. And I was like, oh my God, do you realize you have the choice between prescribed fire and a little bit of smoke or a catastrophic fire and breathing like 600 PPM smoke for a month? It was just like this complete lack of understanding. People don't like trees cut, right? Because we've had it hammered into us to don't cut trees, don't cut trees, don't cut trees, plant, 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 right? But that's very context specific. That's really appropriate in some places like the East Coast, perhaps, and tropical areas. But where we've created these hazardously overgrown forests, we have to pull some trees out to save forests, right? So we have to think more systemically. So the nonprofit was really focused on identifying the big gaps in this space originally, educating the public, educating big funders like the Giving Pledge families on the catastrophic fire problem. Why is it happening? What are the solutions? Once I saw the tech play that just somebody had to build the platform that we've built, I really struggled with how a grant-funded system would actually be able to serve actual customer needs. Grants often force a focus on what the grant is mandating, not what a user needs, right?
Right.
I also worried about being able to scale something fast enough because we are so out of time on this issue. I can't emphasize that enough. And so I felt like venture backing with a killer tech team, and often tech people will only join if they have some ownership, right? Like, some folks are finishing their career in Silicon Valley and moving to a nonprofit, but you know, if they can build something that has value and makes a difference, that's a big preference. For all those reasons, decided to spin a public benefit corporation out of the nonprofit. We have a hybrid structure where the two work together. And on the public benefit corp, where I now sit, we build this killer data and this killer tech, all these applications to answer questions like land management. Where do I go with my money to get the most bang for the buck? We'll get into more software as a service for carbon, water, biodiversity project developers. We'll be getting into insurance and solutions for utility sectors, leveraging our same kind of data core and our capabilities we've built now in decision support, monitoring those kinds of things. The nonprofit is now, it's honed its focus to be what we call a data commons. So as we build out data like our fine scale vegetation data, we make that data publicly available to the agency and scientific community to further science. So use our billion tree map to understand all kinds of functions about forests and study lots of things using remote sense data. And we'll have all kinds of novel data sets that we make publicly available. So that's one of our big impact pieces as a public benefit corp, is to give that data away and let the scientific community have at it.
And I'm curious what it has been like fundraising for this company, knowing the background, knowing it spun out from the nonprofit, and also knowing the data piece that you just mentioned. people love moats, people love proprietary data, investors love all of those kind of buzzword terms. And so how has it been fundraising?
We have been really lucky, partly because of past relationships, to get some incredible people behind us early. Our own chief product officer, Neil Hunt, who was the chief product officer at Netflix for 18 years. He built the platform we all enjoy. I worked with Neil a long time ago. He saw the potential here. He's a forest landowner. He owns a little bit of land in the Sierra. Very, very worried about fire. Very, very worried about climate change. And so when I told him what was needed in the space and what we intended to build, when we formed our public benefit corp, he jumped on the board and gave us the initial funds to build a minimum viable product that could actually show what was possible with a remote sensed, data-driven decision support tool. So I'm very grateful to him. He later jumped in with both feet, pulled himself out of what he was working on before. He's our chief product officer, also still on the board with me and really guiding this company. And it's such a pleasure to work with him again. Other people like Chris Cox, who's the head of product at Meta, also saw the same kind of potential. He's a big climate investor. So we had a few folks, Grantham Foundation, big climate investor, that really wanted to see the modernization of these kinds of nature-based climate solutions and also risk mitigation that got behind us early. That gave us enough to hire up a team that could really demonstrate what we were talking about. Because you can imagine in sort of an old world space, it's like, what are you talking about? Like, change is very hard in these sort of slow, more bureaucratic spaces. And so that really helped us. And then later we got incredible investors like Ecosystem Integrity Fund. The partner that we work with there, Jamie Everett, is a former forester. He totally got it. So we've just been lucky where we've gotten just the right introductions to folks that saw the need, knew what we were building was absolutely audacious at first. Because we basically, this wasn't a typical kind of software business where you could build sort of a nice consulting business or a little kind of pilot app and then slowly grow it as you had demand for it. We had to build sort of full tilt boogie. We had to invest a ton in the team that we've got scientifically and from a machine learning perspective to build that foundational model I talked about and to normalize these really complicated data sets, because we're basically doing our best to mimic nature. Nature is very, very complicated. And so it took a lot of people that are very, very, you know, top end scientists and engineers to actually build this foundation. And then we also sell to government. And that takes a long time. So we finally have a federal blanket purchase agreement. We're starting to have a really deep partnership with the Forest Service and starting to work on other federal agencies like the Department of Interior and others, tribes too. And so now we're at a point where we've got enough traction. We've been able to attract investors like Microsoft and City Impact Fund and others that are now helping us into this new growth phase and really, really tackle new markets.
And talking a little bit about yourself, I guess growing up, did you always want to start a company? Like, did you ever think that one day you would start a company like this?
Hell no. Never did. It's funny. I almost feel like I fell into it. It was just sort of a couldn't not do this. I did run my own consulting firm for 20 years, but it was just me with a stable of writers and designers and others that I would pull in for different projects when I was working with eBay, Google, and Facebook. And there I was sort of like an insider, even though I was a contractor, I really worked inside with teams very deeply for many years at a time. So yeah, I never imagined I would co-found and be the CEO of a tech company. In some ways though, it's like so many other things in my life and others' lives where you kind of look hindsight in retrospect, it all makes sense. You know, I've worked with some of the most incredible CEOs in my career, like Reed Hastings at Netflix and Mark Zuckerberg at Meta and the leadership at Google. And so I've been able to pick up along the way leadership styles. Some of my work was sort of culture change oriented too over those years where I was helping some of those leaders set vision, set strategy, and then galvanize big groups of employees around where a CEO or a leader like Chris Cox wants to head. And so, you know, just started to learn what works. And so trying my best to apply that in my own company that is, you know, now inherently one of the hard things is as a consultant, you're sort of only as good as your client. And I saw this as an opportunity to build a company that inherently does good. Like the core of the company, it's making money for the investors, but it's not quite yet, but it will. And it's inherently having this massive social and ecological impact. And so that feels really good. And that was something that always felt a little bit, I had some dissonance around that with companies I'd worked with, you know, in the past.
And what is it like working with all of these different groups? Because I know sort of throughout this conversation, you've mentioned the government working with people like firefighters, also working with indigenous tribes and people who have known the land a lot longer than a lot of us have. What is it like kind of being able to bring all of these groups together on a platform? Because I know, I'm sure they all have different needs. They all approach these issues differently. I can imagine indigenous tribes who would be a little distrusting of sort of new solutions coming in as well for good reason. What is it like bringing everyone together on this issue and being able to kind of create the platform that can allow for that collaboration?
Yeah, it's been really interesting. I mean, a lot of this was starting to happen in that paper-driven process I described earlier anyway. So, you know, at least different jurisdictions, Forest Service, BLM, national state parks, private landowners, they were already trying to build consensus around what do we envision in this watershed, 300,000 acres, a million acres. It was just really hard. So collaboration had started partially, like I said, forced by severe fire crossing boundaries, right? Like fire doesn't care who owns the land.
Right.
Bark beetle sweeping, killing billions of trees. It doesn't care who owns the land. So consensus-driven processes had already been birthed. Tribes, however, have sort of been doing their own thing. And there's a really significant change happening right now. There's a new mature and old growth bill that came through Congress that's been in the news a lot lately, for example. That bill mandates the fact that Western science and indigenous knowledge have equal weight in planning how we protect and manage in and around old growth for the United States. That's kind of a first of its kind legislation that puts indigenous knowledge on the table with equal weight, mandated in a bill. So I'm very excited about those kinds of moves, especially if the Biden administration is able to proceed. Of course, Deb Haaland, the head of the Department of Interior, is our first tribal member that's leading the biggest natural resource agency in the country. So there's real opportunity to infuse and sort of reintroduce indigenous knowledge and how we manage land, which there's wide acceptance. There's almost a fervor for that. In fact, tribal leads like Margot Robbins in the Kirk tribe in the Pacific Northwest is teaching. She runs a big burn boss training program to help teach people all over the country how to apply a beneficial fire. There's a lot happening. My hope is that our platform can help tribes manage their data as sovereign data. They are their own countries, right? And so there's a lot of sensitivity around that. But with advanced technology, we can keep those things secure, right? Like we don't want to expose where ancient tribal sites are, where ancestral archaeological areas are, because silly people will go dig them up. So some of these things have to be handled very, very carefully. And I think the weird thing is we can bring modern technology to an ancient issue and also help everybody see and sort of reconnect with land the way tribes managed it for thousands of years. I mean, that's the holy grail, is to really get back to the reciprocal relationship that, you know, tribes had with nature for 20,000 years. We've got to basically, instead of trying to control, going back to the control thing, instead of trying to control everything, we really have to connect with what's around us and understand what's healthy and what we need to do to move things to health and resilience and be active in it. So that's really what our system is helping people do. It's just funny that we're kind of meeting people where they are with advanced technology to reconnect to what we should have been doing 20,000 years ago.
And I could listen to you talk forever. Oh, my gosh.
Oh,
but before we leave, we do have one more question, and that's what's next? And then on top of that, like, are you going to tackle water next? I want to know what's next. Are you going to hit all the elements?
Yeah, we basically are now, because our system is helping to manage across the elements, water, biodiversity, carbon, and fire. In terms of what's next, so we are just about to, our system will be available west-wide in all Western U.S. states. We now have the methodology to export that. So our hope is this year we'll start to move internationally in places like Greece, Portugal, which have horrible fires, Chile. Our chief scientist just did a fellowship down in Chile to work with them on some of their strategy for fire. They had horrible fires this summer for them a few months ago. So that's one goal, is to take this where it's needed most in the world, again, before it's too late, before we permanently lose some of these critical ecosystems. We're also really starting to think about, we've got all this sort of nature accounting. So we've got all these values of natural capital inherently in our system. And then how doing this or that affects those values positively or negatively sometimes. And so we're starting to think about this sort of nature accounting space and the need with ESG. Also, the Task Force on Nature Disclosures is sort of an emerging framework that a lot of companies are signing on to. I think we can be really helpful to, you know, again, connect corporations to ecosystems and understand the effects of what they invest in, what they're buying, those kinds of things. So that's a sort of an emerging space that we're thinking about. And then finally, we have some pilots starting to happen with our partners at American Forest Foundation, incredible organization. If you want to support a great org that's really pioneering the highest quality forest carbon for small family landowners. So we're starting to bring the program that they birthed, working with small family landowners on forest carbon offset programs to create a new source of income for small families. We're bringing that west in fire adapted landscapes, starting with some pilots this year. So super excited about that.
This has been a total pleasure. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me. It was so much fun talking to both of you.
And that was our conversation with Allison. And before we move on, looking in at what was the lie was that there's one unified group that handles land management in most of the U.S., which was pretty interesting to know. I mean, I know that I don't understand anything about what happens in government oversight, who does what, whatever. I feel like any question I have, I always have to look it up. But I think that is kind of what makes this platform so interesting, is the collaboration part of it. If so many people oversee the land, and then of course there's so many groups that would care about what happens to land or care about how to develop it or how to prevent things. It's like interesting to think of building a platform that caters to everyone all at once.
I know, and the US is big, massive, huge. I often say it's too big, but not going into that. But just imagining the different type of environments that the land used to have before the colonial settlers came in, and just thinking about what is needed to take care of that land and really knowing the wants and the needs, especially as the environment changes. How do you take care of a land that you never really knew? Which is also really good why the company works with indigenous tribes, because they know how to take care of this land. They've been doing it for like thousands of years.
Yeah. No, I thought that piece of it was not only super smart as just like a business strategy wise, but also just like the right thing to do. Like if you were trying to build this and you were going off of just new technology or new approaches, it just isn't the full picture. Like if you're trying to get back to a space, especially which like it seems like a lot of us are trying to do, where it's like we have less of a harm on the environment, less of an impact, building a platform that doesn't account for how people took care of the land prior to the impact we've currently had would just be kind of silly. Like the information is right there. Like, why would you not work with the people who know what they're talking about and stuff? And I feel, especially with indigenous groups, I feel there's mistrust of how people are treating their land and how the government approaches things like that, which is very well-founded mistrust for sure. So it's nice to see that this is just bridging a lot of gaps, I feel, in that space.
Yeah. And it seems to be such a nuanced issue, just thinking about everything that goes into, I'm like going back to, when did I have biology in like the seventh grade? Biodiversity. Mm-hmm. And I just remember there's a lot of it. I can't even go into the details about it, but just understanding the biodiversity, the vegetation, the what it takes to put all of this together, and then creating a technology that can specifically address those issues. But then doing that for the United States, which is once again, big girl. Like, I really like this product. I think it's timely, it's needed, and I really do like the collaborative aspect of it.
Yeah, because like biodiversity is so huge. I know there's a new venture firm. I wrote about their launch. It was sometime during 2023, I want to say maybe in the summer, called Superorganism. And their whole thesis is backing companies that preserve biodiversity or like preserve nature, because they're like, it's crazy how little people realize that if we work to preserve certain things, it like takes care of some of our other issues. So it's like everyone wins in this scenario. But I definitely wanted to talk about the AI piece here too, because it seems like it would be kind of a difficult model to train just with how much biodiversity there is, even if it is less than there used to be. It's so complex and complicated. It seems like it'd be hard to train an AI model on this data set, but I could definitely see where, because this is such a fluid area, that once it did learn, it would be really helpful to have something like AI to help scale this technology.
Yeah, I was also going to bring that up. It seems to be such an intricate thing. I truly don't know how you train an AI model on this, but I'm not a machine learning expert at all, but I imagine—
yeah, no one's asking us to.
No one's asking me. But I also imagine it could be, because it seems like there's also new biodiversity that comes out. Like, there's so much about this world that we don't know. And so— how much can you train an AI model when it comes to the environment like this about even a world that we're still trying to figure out? Like, imagine the AI trying to figure out the ocean and we only know like 5% of it. Maybe the AI can learn more because we can drop it down there to the depths or something. Or maybe not, like, because what are we looking for? I think it's also a pretty good use for AI. Like, we should put AI on the front lines of this and figure this out.
I love the thought of putting AI on the front line. Like, let's throw them on the front lines. But yeah.
You get a little robot.
Yeah. No, I mean, stuff like that. It's like, just using this technology makes so much sense here, because I know back in college, I took this environmental reporting class, which was a lot of fun, really a lot of fun. And one of the field trips, we did a lot of field trips. We took a field trip to a marsh. And the guy who is running the research on the marsh, it's Rumney Marsh in Boston, if anyone is familiar with it, he was saying that, and he's like, yeah, we like come here every day, we take these huge advanced computers and we throw them in the ocean. He's like, and then we collect them and then we take the data off of them. But just he was so like, yep, just take a big piece of technology and just toss it right in the ocean. And so like thinking of like applying tech to like draw out these maps and get a better hold on these biodiversity issues. Because I mean, in theory, I'm thinking very in like Sims brain right now. If you were like making a patch of grass or something, say it's an analogy for a field out on the West Coast, the biodiversity in the one square is probably going to be the same if you blew it up to 10 squares, like 10 square feet or something. So I feel like once you figure stuff out, train the AI, that kind of scale, like for forests and things like that, definitely makes a lot of sense here.
I just keep thinking about those life-size robots from Glacier and then having them hike up mountains and just saying like, hike, and then having them go up and look around.
And figure it out, yeah.
And figure it out, yeah.
No, that's where we're headed. That's where we're headed.
Hey, I think that's a good use case for robots. See, I'm pro-robot. But you know what else was really interesting that we didn't talk to her much about was her previous working experience, which she's been everywhere.
Oh, I know. And she tried to like downplay the fact that she was like, oh, well, you know, like the first company I founded and I never wanted to be a founder. And I'm like, I don't know, I would consider running your own consultant firm that got hired by people like Google, Apple, Facebook, now Meta. But like, I would definitely give myself more credit for that.
Yeah, when I saw she was at Netflix back in the day, I was like, oh my gosh, she's been everywhere.
Yeah, she's worked with a lot of the great, quote unquote, like tech minds of the last decade.
The greats.
So yeah, I think she definitely underplays that a little bit, which I think she shouldn't.
No, yeah, this is definitely, she's amazing. And don't underplay it.
No,
own it.
This episode could have easily been like 3 hours long.
I know, I wanted to know more about everything. I felt like I was back in like college lecture.
Oh, I know. But like actually interested, taking notes.
Actually interested,
more.
Yes.
Found is hosted by myself, TechCrunch senior reporter Becca Skutak, alongside senior reporter Dominic Midori-Davis. Found is produced by Maggie Stamets with editing by Kel. Our illustrator is Bryce Durbin. Found's audience development and social media is managed by Morgan Little, Alyssa Stringer, and Natalie Kreisman. TechCrunch's audio products are managed by Henry Pickovit. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week.